Now, it's good to welcome back Brian Hughes, who, as I'm sure you know by now, is consultant solicitor of Shenfield-based Rayner Hughes. And the last few times you were here, Brian, you were looking at the many aspects of relating to issues connected with tenancy agreements between landlords and tenants. And leading on from this, I believe you're going to be looking at this from two angles today, is that so?
Well, hello, Scott. Happy New Year.
And the same to you.
Yes, you're right. I propose to talk about buy-to-let properties and assured short-hold tenancies, but it's such a large subject that I'll have to spread it over two programmes. There are two aspects to buy-to-let properties, and I'm going to start by looking at it from the landlord's point of view. First of all, I'd like to explain a bit of the background to both aspects of a tenanted buy-to-let property from the point of view of the landlord and the tenant, and then deal with assured short-hold tenancies, which are known as ASTs, in detail. One has to ask why there's been such a demand for buy-to-let properties. There are a number of reasons, but Scott, what would you consider is the principal reason for the upsurge, particularly since the banking crisis in 2008?
Surely it's got to be the derisory rates of interest being paid by the banks and building societies. And that, of course, coupled with recent changes governing the rights of individuals and their pension pots, low mortgage rates, and all of that must make property investment a potentially attractive option, I would
guess.
Well,
that's right. The amount of interest banks and building societies have been paying to savers have, as you say, been so derisory that people have been trying to get a better return elsewhere. This applies particularly to people who are about to retire, but low interest rates affect everyone, and most people regard the purchase of a buy-to-let property as a win-win situation. In the case of those approaching retirement, they basically have two options for their pension pot: either buying an annuity which guarantees them an income for life, or buying a second property if their pension pot would cover a purchase. If it does, and there's anything left over, they can spend it on doing up their home, going on a decent holiday, or buying stocks and shares. But if they choose an annuity, it means that they hand over their retirement pot in whole or in part to an annuity provider, usually a large insurance company. In return, the annuity provider will either offer a flat rate income for life or an annuity which has built-in annual increments. But once the pension pot is handed over, that's it. The income on offer is based on the average life expectancy of people like the annuitant, age-wise or health-wise. Some of us will live longer than the average and others less. In that respect, buying an annuity is a bit of a lottery. There are, of course, variations on the above, which anyone interested should explore with a reputable financial consultant. I've just given you a general picture. But many people don't like the idea of handing over their pension pot and taking their chance on surviving long enough to get their money's worth out of annuity.
When I retired, that was the only option that was given. You know, I tell you, as you say, it's all changed. Now, of course, you've covered some of these issues before. So what's the attraction in becoming a landlord?
Well, you can see the obvious attractions for someone who's retiring to invest their pension pot, since the government made this possible, in the purchase of a second property, the proceeds of which, after inheritance tax, can be passed on to their children. In the meantime, he or she, the annuitant, receives, hopefully, a rental income on it, similar to the income they'd have received from an annuity, a rental income, moreover, which will rise over the years as a result of inflation, if nothing else. The value of the property will also probably rise. It's true that the second property will have to be maintained and rent will have to be collected, but for a proportion of the rent, a managing agent can be appointed to do this. And one's children have to be a big consideration these days, because as the prices of houses and flats rise, the more difficult it is for the children or grandchildren to save up a deposit to buy one.
So, presumably, there is, in fact, an interrelationship between people who've retired and put their pension pots into property, thereby increasing the demand for property, and the inability of young people to buy as they see the cost of leasehold flats rising beyond their means. But presumably, of course, at the same time, the parents could buy and put the children in there.
Yes, a fond hope. Well, that's correct. And there's another sort of purchaser, though, who's also driving up the cost of leasehold flats. That's the person who takes advantage of cheap mortgage interest rates and offsets the cost of a mortgage against the rental income they receive. in the expectation not only of a difference in their favour between the two, but also a capital gain fuelled by the increasing demand for this type of property. For them, as I've said, it's a win-win. The government belatedly realised that young people were being priced out of the market and that a problem existed. It therefore decided to try and discourage this type of investor in buy-to-let properties by reducing the tax relief available on mortgage interest payments. From April 2017, there began a progressive reduction in the tax relief available for interest on mortgage payments, which investors had previously been able to offset against rental income in its entirety. Now, investor landlords can only offset 75% of the mortgage interest against rental income, and by 2020, they won't be able to offset any of it at all. I suspect that this will have the effect of pushing up rentals. Buy-to-let investors also now have to pay an extra 3% stamp duty on any buy-to-let property they purchase. This applies to the purchase of any second property or the acquisition of an interest in a second property. The other thing perhaps I should mention is that building society mortgage rates are and have been for many years higher in the case of buy-to-let mortgages than those applicable to residential homeowners, whether freehold or leasehold. So gradually the tax noose is tightening around the necks of people who buy second homes either for retirement income or investment purposes, unless of course they're companies specialising in buying and letting leasehold properties like blocks of flats.
Now, you're talking here, I assume, of England. What would happen if you bought a second property in Wales or Scotland? Does that affect things at all?
I wouldn't have thought so. No, I mean, the same general rules must apply across Wales and Scotland. Prices are obviously lower in those two countries.
Yeah.
But the same general rules apply.
Fair enough, okay. So what's the attraction in becoming a landlord?
Well, in summary, once you purchase a second property, you can potentially earn a profit in two ways. The first is rental yield, what your tenant pays in rent, minus any maintenance and running costs, like repairs and agents' fees. And the second is capital growth, the profit you earn if you sell your property for more than you paid for it. But you do need to bear in mind major repairs that, or difficult tenants might increase your costs. And if you make a profit as an investor when you sell your buy-to-let property, you'll be liable to pay capital gains tax.
So how much is all this going to cost? It don't come cheap, do it?
No. Well, just like buying any other property,
yeah.
You'll also need to allow for survey fees. You don't want to buy the duff property, do you?
Right. Solicitor's
fees and stamp duty land tax. There are also running and maintenance costs associated with any kind of rental property. A letting agent, for example, will charge you a fee. But if you want to use an agent, compare costs to make sure you get the best deal. You'll definitely need buildings insurance, which will also help protect your investment. Then, apart from a concession for first-time buyers, which I'll mention, there's stamp duty land tax, which applies to properties that cost over £125,000.
That must be everything, I should think.
Well, as you've just said, in Wales and Scotland, maybe, you know, you might get it for under that.
Yeah.
But that stamp duty is applicable to both freeholds and leasehold properties, whether you're buying outright or with a mortgage.
And you have to pay income tax on rental income as well, of course.
Yes, as I said, buy-to-let landlords can offset some of their mortgage interest payments and some of their costs against their rental income. But from April 2017, higher and additional rates of relief are gradually being phased out and will be completely phased out for all landlords by April 2020. Now, that gives you a broad picture from a landlord's perspective. And we should now look at the situation from the point of view of the young person or couple wanting to live in a place of their own. The situation's mixed. The government, realising that it was likely to lose the support of the younger part of the electorate, has introduced Help to Buy ISAs and has also cut the stamp duty rate for first-time buyers on the first 300,000 of any leasehold or freehold property which costs under £500,000. But that, in my view, only scratches the surface of the problem, and the concession is likely to be counterbalanced by an increase in the cost of properties they'd like to buy.
Well, that sounds very cynical, Brian.
Well, maybe, yeah. But that's what's likely to happen. And while young people are saving up for a deposit on their purchase, if they can afford one, or if they can't, they'll be usually looking for a rented flat, and that's where ASTs come in.
All right, so let's move on to these assured short-hold tenancy agreements. Just what are they?
Well, put simply, they're contracts between the landlord and the tenant which set out the rights and responsibilities of each party during the period of a rental agreement. Young people will probably have found somewhere to rent by going online and checking the websites of agents who specialise in letting. The rental figure they will see will not usually include the cost of domestic rates, which is an occupier's liability, and the figure will definitely not include the cost of water, gas and electricity. These advertisements will mention the fact that the tenancy will be an AST and may or may not mention that the tenant will have to come up with a rental deposit in addition to the monthly rent. The rental deposit, by the way, is invariably 3 months' rent up front.
So what would one expect from an AST, Brian?
Well, they'll give the tenant a legal right to live in a property for a period of time. This can initially be a period of 6 months, that's the minimum, 12 months, or sometimes 18 months. An AST also gives a tenant the right to live in a property in good repair and the right to information about the tenancy. And it also, importantly, gives protection from eviction.
Okay, so next time you're going to be looking at ASTs in more detail, is that right?
Yeah, indeed. And also the deposit protection scheme and the need to have a detailed inventory of the fixtures, fittings and contents of furnished flats when you actually go in. It's quite a broad subject and needs a talk on its own.
Fair enough. Okay, we'll look forward to that. Have we got a date fixed for that?
Yeah, we have. It's the 12th of February.
Good stuff. All right, look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed, Brian.
Great pleasure.